Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind, and how God prepares the world for the coming of the Messiah through the Old Testament. Our guest again today is Ron Eldren, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, Religion and History. I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, chaplain down at John Paul II Catholic High at 12 Points, and the chaplain at the Carmelites just outside of Terre Haute at the entrance of Allendale. Ron, we've been talking about prophecy and the prophets in general, how after Solomon's kingdom, it broke up into the north and south kingdoms. And then something in general about prophets, who were mainly those who spoke for God, also talked about the future, but mainly messengers from God to tell the people to straighten out their lives and come back to Him. So could we take a look at Elijah in particular? And you have some amazing things to say about Elijah, who is really well known in the Bible, but strangely enough, is not among the four major or the 12 minor prophets.
Although we don't have any books that he wrote in the Bible, he's one of the most important prophets sent to the northern kingdom of Israel. His name means, "The Lord is my God." His successor's name is Elisha, we'll call him Elisha, so that's kind of rhymes with Elijah. He and his successor's story are told in 1 Kings 17 to 2 Kings 10. So, you know, quite a few different chapters of two different books of the Bible. Elijah was sent to the northern kingdom of Israel in the mid-9th century B.C., so the mid-800s B.C., to warn the king and the people that they had broken their covenant with God. Achab was the king, or sometimes he's called Ahab, or a lot of times use the word Ahab.
Is that the one, is that the reason the the famous book, The Whale Hunter, Ahab, wasn't he named after this guy in the Bible?
I can see Gregory Peck playing the role of King Ahab,
Chasing of the White
Captain
Whale.
Ahab, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a connection there or not, but I'll call him Achab.
Okay.
He had become the king of Israel around the year 873 B.C., and he reigned until 854. So he had a fairly long reign. But his wife was the evil Jezebel. And she's a symbol, you know, for wicked women even today.
Sure.
And she was the daughter of the king of Tyre. Or some people have said that he was the king of Sidon, but mostly I see Tyre, which was in Phoenicia, which today is Lebanon, with whom Israel had concluded a treaty. In other words, the marriage was a political alliance. And it wasn't uncommon for a wife from a different country to bring some of the customs of her country to her husband's country. And Jezebel brought the particular evil custom of the worship of the pagan god Baal, or Malkort, who was a storm or a rain god, and perhaps a sun god as well. And the pagan goddess, his consort or whatever, Astarte, or sometimes called Azareth. She was the goddess of fertility, fecundity, lust, or whatever have you. Sacred prostitution was closely associated with the cult of Astarte, and both males and females are believed to have been employed as prostitutes in her temple. One scholar has presumed that, quote, sacred temple prostitution involved young unmarried virgins who offered themselves as representatives of Astarte in fulfillment of a religious vow, End of quote. The worship of Baal and Astarte included not only immorality, but also the killing of children as sacrifices to the gods. King Solomon had first brought her worship to Israel and Judah by way of his wives from that area. Although King Achab was not completely faithless to Yahweh, he had on occasions offered sacrifices to the false pagan god Baal. His wicked king Jezebel and her priests conducted a bloody persecution of the prophets of Yahweh. She tried to force the Israelites to worship her gods throughout the kingdom. And she had those officials who refused to go along with her killed. Faithful Israelites had to hide in caves during this time, living on bread and water to survive. One historian has said that, quote, Achab was at a disadvantage. Not only was Jezebel a stronger personality than her husband, but also Tyre was stronger than Israel. And then you keep in mind now her father is the king of Tyre. Therefore, Achab did nothing to stop his strong-willed wife from having her way.
Wow, startling. The Deuteronomic theme is operative here again, Ron, that the Israelites are to be rewarded when they keep the covenant with God and punished when they break it.
Yeah, that's right, over and over again. God sent his prophet Elijah to warn Achab for his and the people's sins. As a consequence, it would not rain for 3.5 years, causing a terrible famine to envelop the land. God gave Elijah power to work great miracles, such as raising the dead, calling down fire from heaven to consume the Holocaust, outrunning the king's chariot for 28 miles. And that's one story. And by making a dry path through the Jordan. These stories are told in 1 Kings and 2 Kings in different places. And by performing these miracles, he convinced Israel that Yahweh and Yahweh alone was true God. Since he was totally detached from caring for his own bodily needs, he was fed by ravens, by an angel, and by a widow raising her son from the dead for the good deeds she'd done for him. One source describes him as a, quote, wild-looking figure dressed only in hair cloak and a leather loincloth. He had lived a lonely life trying to persuade the Israelites to abandon their worship of the devilish Phoenician gods and return to the one true God, end of quote.
Okay, Ron, this brings us to the famous duel between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the false god of Baal. Can you tell us that story that's quite famous in the Old Testament?
Yes, this truly is one of the most famous stories in the Old Testament. It's told in 1 Kings 18. During the famine, Elijah had approached King Achab, who called him a troublemaker. And Elijah challenged him and 450 of the Baal priests to a duel of the gods, the false god of Baal and the true god Yahweh. Elijah told Achab to, quote, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel. And the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Azareth, or Astarte, who eat at Jezebel's table. So Achab sent all of the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. That ends that quote from the Bible. Elijah instructed that 2 bulls be provided to be killed and cut up, and each placed separately on piles of wood. Then he said to the Baalist priest, quote, you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the Lord who answers by fire, he is God. End of quote. As one historian has said of this event, quote, to refuse would be to admit that their God was a fraud. End of quote. The Baalist priests danced in a frenzy around the bull, cutting themselves with swords and lances while futilely calling upon the name of Baal from morning until noon. And the priest shouted, quote, O Baal, answer us. For there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped after the altar, which they had made, end of quote. Of course, they're limping because they've wounded themselves with their instruments. All the while, Elijah was making fun of them and their impotent God. The historian I just quoted says, with respect to Elijah's actions, quote, "But the more difficult he made it appear, the greater the effect on his audience. And he wanted to lose no opportunity to mock the powerlessness of Baal," end of quote. The irony of this whole story is that Baal was the Phoenician god, rain god and storm god. After the priest was exhausted, Elijah constructed an altar with 12 stones, one representing, of course, each of the tribes, the 12 tribes. And he made a trench around the altar. Then he piled the wood on the altar and laid the cut-up pieces of the bull on it. And to really rub it in, he had a water poured over the bull and the wood, and then had the trench filled with water. When the sacrifice was prepared, Elijah called to the Lord, saying, quote, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that thou, O Lord, art God, and that thou hast turned their hearts back." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." End of quote. Afterward, Elijah ordered the people to kill the Baal priest, and he prayed for rain, and soon a small cloud appeared over the sea. You see, the Mount Carmel is right up next to the Mediterranean Sea, fairly close. It's only about 300 feet high, something like that. You've probably seen it, Father.
Yes.
I think there's a church probably on the top of it. And so from the top of the hill, obviously, you can see the Mediterranean. So a little cloud forms out over the Mediterranean, and then it develops into a mighty rainstorm. And the rains came and fell in torrents upon thirsty Israel, ending the drought.
And that had been called by Elijah for 3.5 years.
Right.
So a mighty miracle to make a new beginning. Okay, now, with all this being done, and the prophets are killed by Elijah's command, what happens to Elijah after this startling event on Mount Carmel or Mount Carmel?
Of course, wicked Queen Jezebel ordered Elijah's arrest, but became very angry when she heard that he had fled for his life to Sinai, where God spoke to him in a gentle breeze and sent him back to anoint a new king and a new prophet. The new king was Jehu, who had all of Jezebel's court killed, and she herself was thrown to her death from a balcony window. And the new prophet was Elisha. He's Elijah's successor. Soon afterwards, Elijah was taken up to heaven in a fiery chariot and horses, having accomplished his mission. Of course, that's a famous story that always gave credence to the story that he would return someday. And in the New Testament, he does return on the Mount of the Transfiguration. Because he never died a natural death, as I said, it's always assumed that he would return. And some thought that John the Baptist was Elijah returning from heaven to earth. And he and Moses did appear, as I said, at the transfiguration of Jesus on the mountain. This story is told in Matthew 17:3. Moreover, certain passages of the New Testament can be interpreted to mean that Elijah will return to earth before the second coming of Jesus. We find this also in Matthew 17:11 and Mark 9:11. As one historian has said of Elijah, that he, quote, "had brought the northern kingdom back to the true God for a while, but they had not yet learned their lesson about the dangers and insufficiencies of earthly prosperity. The kingdom tore itself to pieces in civil war. In 14 years, there were 6 kings, 5 of them dying by assassination, end quote.
It's a bloody story. Well, Ron, you mentioned King Jehu a while ago. What can you tell us about King Jehu?
Well, actually, he was anointed by Elijah's successor, Elisha, or maybe one of his students. Elisha is noted for crossing the Jordan by striking it with Elijah's cloak, raising to life the child of the Shunammite woman. One of the most famous stories is healing the leprosy of the Syrian Naaman and blinding the Syrians. It is reported that he even his dead body prophesied. That's found in Sirach 48:13. The story of King Jehu is told in 2 Kings 9, chapters 9 through 10. Keep in mind, Achab and Jezebel, they're still ruling Israel when Elijah anoints Elisha a prophet. And Achab was killed in battle, though, against the Syrians. And as Elijah had foretold in 1 Kings 21:19, and after Achab's death, Jezebel continued to rule through her son Ahaziah. When Ahaziah was killed in battle, she controlled her other son, Jehoram. And during his reign, Jehoram was wounded in battle at Ramoth-Gilead against the army of the Arameans. And he was taken to Jezreel to recover. And King Ahaziah of Judah, who happened to be his nephew, also went there to be with him during his convalescence. There's a little bit more about the story here. As it unfolds, the Israelite army commanders met to discuss various matters away from the king. And while they were in the meeting, a student sent by Elisha took Jehu aside and anointed him king of Israel. Then he left. When Jehu's fellow commanders heard that what had happened, they proclaimed him king. And afterwards, Jehu took a small group of soldiers to Jezreel, where the king was convalescing, and Jehu killed him with an arrow in the heart as he was attempting to escape in his war chariot. And Judah's king, Ahaziah, was also killed. And keep in mind now, that's one of Jezebel's daughters, while trying to escape in his chariot. And when Jehu and his band entered the city, that's when he saw the dead king's mother, Queen Jezebel, standing by a palace window. And he ordered the royal eunuchs to toss her from the window. And the fall was fatal, and her body was eaten by dogs, as had been prophesied. Once he got control of Samaria, he called all of the worshippers of Baal together in the capital, and he had them killed. And their temple destroyed. And so King Jehu is reported to have reigned from about 842 to 815.
Okay, so it seems that Jehu was a pretty faithful king of Israel?
Well, he gets mixed reviews from biblical scholars. On the one hand, he did a lot to get rid of the worship of Baal for a while in the northern kingdom. But in other ways, he failed to be a good king. In fact, he's usually counted among the unfaithful kings of Israel because he tolerated the worship of golden calves at the temples at Dan and Bethel in the northern kingdom of Israel. And God was displeased with him for this. As a consequence, he was defeated in battle against the Syrians. This story is told in 2 Kings 10.
Okay, now we've been talking about the two kingdoms divided after Solomon, the northern kingdom, 10.5 tribes, and the southern kingdom, 1 tribe and Benjamin. So let's talk a little bit specifically about the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel.
Israel never really came back to the worship of the true God, even after many severe warnings from several prophets. They'd been warned time and again that they would be severely punished if they didn't reform their evil ways, especially their worship of false gods. Israel had 20 kings from Solomon's death in 720 or 730, whichever it was, until the Assyrian conquest in 722. Sometimes you see the date 721. And not one of them was a good man. a good king. In fact, most of them were wicked men who promoted and practiced idolatry. The biggest threat to their security was the Assyrians to the north, who were a Semitic people, like the Hebrews, living in Upper Mesopotamia, which of course would be in what's Iraq today. Although they had been subjugated by other empires for centuries, eventually the Assyrians were able to build their own empire, subjugating many peoples in the process, including the Israelites in 722 or 21. The Assyrians had a reputation for being bloodthirsty in their conquest, killing countless men, women, and children. I've seen pictures of statues and reliefs carved on walls that shows some of these kind of atrocities that they would engage in when they conquered people. Scott Hahn says of this practice, quote, "Their art and literature shows a real delight in war and killing, as though massacre were the national sport," end of quote. The Assyrian capital was Nineveh, which was an enormous city of hundreds of thousands of people. Hahn writes of Nineveh, quote, "The city was richer than anyone could imagine, swollen with loot, pillaged from all over the known world. To the people of Israel and Judah, who lived in constant fear of Assyrian attack, Nineveh was the symbol of everything that was evil in the world, as we saw in the story of Jonah." You remember we talked about the story of Jonah a little earlier. He was, one of the prophets.
Sent by God to tell the Ninevites to repent.
Who happened to be Gentiles, of course.
And that's why Jonah didn't want to go.
So not all the prophets were sent to Israelites.
Okay, the end of the northern kingdom of Israel was about to happen. What about this disaster?
As the Assyrians were gradually advancing toward Israel, Hoshea, the last king of Israel, tried to play the Israelites off against the Egyptians, the Assyrians off against the Egyptians, which was a big mistake. After losing a battle with the Assyrians, the Israelites paid annual tribute to Nineveh. And when the tribute failed to arrive one year, they didn't send it nowhere one year, the Assyrians discovered that Hoshea was trying to form a secret alliance with the Egyptians to help Israel break away. You have to keep in mind now, Israel, or the Assyrians, that's a big kingdom to the north, or empire to the north. Egypt is another kingdom to the south, or empire to the south. So the Holy Land is squeezed right in between these two empires that are at each other's throat quite a bit. The Assyrians certainly didn't want the Egyptians to gain a foothold in Israel, so the Assyrian king, Shalmaneser, came down with a huge army and besieged Samaria, the capital of Israel. This happened in 722 or 721. After a siege, the Assyrians conquered the city, and the northern kingdom of Israel was ended. And as a consequence, thousands of Israelites were forced to resettle elsewhere in the Assyrian empire.
Okay, this is a tragic time for Israel. Tell us a little more about the resettlement after the Assyrians had come in and conquered Samaria, the kingdom of the capital of the northern kingdom.
Well, it tells the story of what happened to the 10 lost tribes of Israel. You know, we've heard this expression over the years, the 10 lost tribes. To prevent revolts by conquered subjects against their rule, the Assyrians forced the surviving conquered peoples, and not just the Israelites, but any other people as well, to migrate in large numbers in other areas of the empire and replace them with other peoples from other parts of the empire. In other words, the ones they didn't kill when they conquered the territory. One scholar says of this forced migration, quote, "Besides guaranteeing the security of an empire built off of conquered people of different cultures and languages, these mass deportations of the population in the Middle East, Mesopotamia, and Armenia turned the region into a melting pot of diverse cultures, religions, and languages," end of quote. The resettlement of the Israelites of the northern kingdom of Israel came to be known as the 10 Lost Tribes of Israel. One scholar has written that the Israelites simply, quote, "disappeared nameless and faceless to the sands of the northern Mesopotamia, end of quote. Only part of some of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali, which had been conquered by the Assyrians earlier, before 722 or 21, remained in their homeland, which was the rural province of Galilee, or came to be. Over 25,000 of its people, mostly from the leadership class, this is of course from the northern kingdom, the whole northern kingdom of Israel, over 25,000 of its people, mostly from the leadership class, were forcibly removed from their homes and resettled in other parts of the Assyrian Empire, to be replaced by refugees from other conquered lands. This story is told in 2 Kings, especially in chapter 17. However, another scholar has estimated that only a fifth of the population, maybe about 40,000 people, were actually resettled out of the area during the two deportation periods under the Assyrian kings. Tiglath-Pileser and Sargon II, these were two of the kings, the Assyrian kings during that time. Moreover, many of the inhabitants of Israel, especially the Levites, that's the priestly class, those who came from the tribe of Levi, they fled south to Jerusalem before they could be carried off or killed, which appears to have expanded so much during this period that a new wall had to be built and a new source of water provided, that is, the city of Jerusalem. So many people came from the north that they had to, they had to expand the city and add another wall around it. The refugees who settled in Israel intermarried with the Israelites who were left, most of them were probably poor farmers. However, as Hans says, quote, all the leading citizens were gone, and the tribal structure of most of the 10 northern tribes was dissolved, end of quote. The transplanted foreigners brought their own gods, but after a while they adopted the Israelite religion, but with misunderstandings and errors. And for example, they continued to worship foreign gods from all over the Assyrian Empire. Moreover, the Jews had believed that sacrifice was to be offered only to the temple in Jerusalem, but the people in the north, who were called Samaritans after the capital city, also offered sacrifices in their own temple in high places. And the Jews in the south, they resented the Samaritans. And this is the origin of the strong hatred between the Jews and Samaritans at the time of Christ. The Levites and many others who remained faithful to the true faith escaped to Jerusalem, and some who were carried away into captivity remained faithful, though, like Tobias, for example. And even after the fall of Israel, Isaiah prophesied that one day Naphtali would see the light of the deliverance, a hope that was fulfilled when Jesus made the cities of Naphtali the center of his Galilean ministry. Eventually, the Assyrian Empire was to be conquered by the Medes and the Babylonians.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of the program just about, Ron. We've finished about the destruction of the Northern Kingdom, and next time we'll take up a little more about the Southern Kingdom of Judah, which is still left after the destructions by the Assyrians to the Northern Kingdom. To our radio audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.